And if you want to hang around, actually, Maruf is already in the space with his camera. I don't know where he currently is. He'll share with us in a moment. But you are more than welcome to stay. He is sharing a little bit about Alay's Farm, which is his project in Guinea. And they actually had to pivot also as part of COVID-19. So, hey, Maruf, nice to see you.
Hi, nice to see you, Monique. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, Maruf, share a little bit, where are you right now? And talk a little bit about Alay's Farm for those students that haven't met you in the Accelerate space yet.
Absolutely. So, I'm currently in Senegal, West Africa. I'm here because I ran away from COVID. I was actually doing my semester abroad in Berlin, and we had to come back to the States, but I decided to come to Senegal. I had envisioned to stay in Senegal for just a couple weeks and then go back to Guinea, my home country, where Alay's Farm is based off. But unfortunately, due to COVID, the borders are closed. So I ended up doing almost three months here. But it's both a blessing and a curse. And we've done a lot of changes to our business to manage what we're doing right now. So Alay's Farm is a company that cultivates, processes, and exports red palm oil. What we do is we connect smallholder farmers with members of the African diaspora. So members of the African diaspora being Africans that live outside of the continent, but which are still looking for an African root in the food that they consume. So we wanted to provide a high quality product at a fair price for the members of the diaspora. And on the other hand, increase wages for smallholder farmers, enable them to not only increase their yields, but reduce their impacts. This is a very, very interesting time for us. We started Alay's Farm in between 2013 and 2014, which was in the beginning of the Ebola crisis. So we started in the middle of the Ebola crisis, and we've signed our largest contract in the middle of the coronavirus. So it's very difficult, but we accept the challenges, and we like to change our strategies and work accordingly to benefit as many people as we can. I had a presentation started, but unfortunately my brother came and surprised me with this. So I kind of got distracted. So at the end of the presentation, I will email everyone which is interested pictures of and more documentation in regards to Alay's Farm. So right now we're in Africa, and we have to really consider the situation and how we combat the coronavirus. It's a luxury to be able to stay at home. It's a luxury to be able to work from home. And unfortunately, it's not the case here for most people in Africa, especially here in Senegal. A lot of people here live on a day-by-day basis. They eat what they make, what they grow themselves, or from the sales that they make in that specific day. Therefore, the way the government has been managing the virus was not by creating confinements, but it was just by having very strict laws in terms of the masks that you wear, the gatherings, and there's curfews. So we started off with a very early curfew, 8 p.m. till 5 a.m. No one can be outside. Everyone has to stay home. That impacted a lot of people, a lot of businesses, restaurants, and such. But when we came here, having a lot more time to really reflect on our business, we wanted to continue with our mission. We are still doing large-scale agriculture in Guinea, and we're still exporting at slower rates, obviously, because The worldwide logistics and supply chain systems are definitely affected. There's a higher priority for medical equipment. So we sat back and decided to make a home garden. So I'm here right now in the home garden. I hope the Wi-Fi doesn't break out, but this is it right over here.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it just looks green. But what we were trying to focus on is bio-intensive agriculture, meaning that we want to grow as many crops as possible in the smallest space. And we focused on things that we liked, things that we consumed all the time. So I'm going to hop into the garden and show you guys a bit. So we started off with all types of herbs. So right here we've got mint. We also obviously recycled. So this is a recycled cupboard that we just put on the floor, drilled a couple holes in it. We generate our own compost by the waste that we use at home. And honestly, we're very surprised. We had maybe 4 plants and now the whole buckets are full. So in here we have mint, we have rosemary, we have basil, we have thyme, we have coriander, and we have lemongrass. And then we decided to go into another level and create a bed. We wanted a large bed, and we focused on soil. We're very blessed to be in Africa. There's a lot of sun, and in Senegal, it's a little drier than in Guinea, so we consume, our water costs went up tremendously. My mom's still pretty mad at me about that, but when she saw the end product, she was very happy. So we focused on creating a soil which was extremely rich with our compost, horse manure, and this is what we ended up with. The idea was to take a selection of seeds and just grab them and throw them into the bed, and this miracle grew. We wanted truly the best seeds. So we just toss them. If they survive, thank God. If they don't, then another plant or another crop will survive. The key here is to replicate what we see in nature. Instead of having something closer to monoculture, meaning one plant growing on one piece of land and it's just rows and rows of that same plant, we're doing something called permaculture, which is a mixture of multiple plant trees, which kind of complement each other through their given properties. So a good example of this is this tree. It's a grenadier tree. And right below it, we've planted mint. And this the mint allows the tree to have the nutrients that it needs, and the tree kind of protects the mint from other elements. And by following these principles, we saw that in a very small piece of land, you could grow something as big as this melon, or there's a small watermelon over there. And we've seen that most people that came over to the house were extremely excited by how fast the garden grew and how much food was actually being produced. So I'll show you an example of a cucumber that we harvested today. And this is it. And it's fairly big, and we have tons and tons more. We've seen that the cucumbers have been very successful, and we're trying to replicate the same type of environment for future purposes. Now, as the people came over to the house, they wanted to have the same thing. but not everyone wants to take the time to truly create a very strong soil. Not everyone knows much about plants. They don't know much about how you trim them. They don't know which plants pair well together. So we decided to create raised beds, and we call them tables. And we each table has a specific theme. So one example of a theme could be an Italian table. On that table, there would be tomatoes, basil, parsley, bell peppers, and spice. And an example of this table would look like this one over here. So this table over here is 1 meter by a meter 20. And on this specific table, we have two different types of lettuce. We have tomatoes, we have green onions, we have spice, and yeah, that's it. And so far we've sold to two main clients. The first client we're extremely proud of is the Senegalese Agency for Reforestation. They reached out to us because they're working on a project called the Green Wall. The Green Wall is a humongous project which goes across the continent of Africa from Senegal all the way to Somalia, so from coast to coast. And it's a green wall made out of vegetation, trees, different plants, which separate northern Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. And it's also a method which enables combat desertification. So they have a lot of employees taking care of those trees, taking care of the whole logistics of that humongous project. I'm very proud to say that Senegal is one of the best countries which are putting their best foot forward for this project. And they also wanted to be self-sufficient in their food consumption. So we provided them with over 1,000 tomato plants, a couple hundred eggplants and onions. And they've been very satisfied with what we've got so far. And we decided, all right, this is an opportunity to replicate the small model of intensive agriculture in a small plot of land. To give you a perspective, this is just 30 meters squared, and we're maybe using a third of it. The rest is just, you know, roses that we planted, different trees, and it looks kind of messy, but there's it's like nature, you know. It makes sense. There's some order to this mess. And we've realized that we could give this to, we can sell this to homes. So our second client is actually an American doctor, a chiropractor. He has a big house, and then he has a rooftop. And he wanted to become a bit more independent in his food consumption. But he also has three kids, and these three kids, since schools are closed, they're extremely bored. They have online classes. Even I have online classes right now. You know, I love my school, but online is not so fun. We miss that sense of interactivity. So we made tables for them, and it's just beautiful to see the kids plant a seed, water it, and a couple days later we come over to visit to see how their plants are doing, and having the kids being excited saying, hey, look, the watermelon plant is starting to grow, when are we going to have watermelons? And just having that sense of excitement, empowering the kids to take control of also what they eat and what they grow. Simultaneously, we realize that this is a great opportunity, because the plants that we do grow end up having more harvest than people end up consuming. So most of the time, what we grow from here, we end up giving away. And that is kind of the spirit in which Elise Farm is born, and in which we want to continue this project that we're calling Elise Urban Farm. Each person that buys a table pledges to give the extra crops, the extra harvest, either back to us so that we could redistribute them, or to neighbors or to people of need. And as we began speaking to more and more people about this project, they really enjoyed it, and people are starting to actually offer spaces in their backyard, spaces in their rooftops, where we have real estate agents that come up to us and say, hey, we want to buy 10, 15, 20 of your tables so that our tenants can just go upstairs and cut tomatoes, or if they need a little bit more parsley for their pasta or whatever it may be, they can just be in the comfort of their own home and eat healthy and crops of good quality. So I think in retrospect, our goal was to decentralize large-scale agriculture in urban cities to enable faster access, local access, higher quality, and food security. Once again, since there's a lot of issues with logistics, a lot of people are having, a lot of crops are taking longer to arrive to destination. Therefore, they might expire. Therefore, they might not sell in time. There tends to be a lot more issues. But since we're in the luxury of having the African sun, and you know, we might have the extra cost of being in the city and paying high prices for water, but we can control what we eat. So yeah, I'll open up the floor for more questions, and hopefully I can show you more plants as we do so.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Marouf. This is a really cool story. I love how you ended up pivoting while you're also away from the actual farm in Guinea. I like the concept of LA's urban farm, and I can see a lot of collaboration potential between CJ, Leon, and yourself. I know you've already connected with each other, so just sounds interesting.
Absolutely, yeah. I have to say that in terms of inspirations for this project, CJ and Leon are definitely two individuals that I looked up for, asked questions about, and learned a lot about.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked before a little bit about how do you coordinate, right, the access to the garden, and the concept of you're essentially growing as much as you want, but then you have access, and you're giving it away, and that is like part of you know, the proposition when you're starting this project. It does require some logistical coordination, and I think that goes back to what CJ and Leon were talking about, that you can go to the public open gardens, but then how do you control who gets food, you know, or are you just an out of luck, or, you know, how do you determine demand and supply? So I think there is an opportunity space here to really augment that with technology, and how you might be able to actually track what Leon suggested before, track what is growing where. So you know where to find the tomatoes, you know where you find the strawberries, but then also how do you help with distribution on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Logistics is always going to be an issue. Access is always going to be an issue. Therefore, like our focal points are in the locations where there's high density, you know. Although our first two customers were very different to what we've imagined, we're still a for-profit business. And what we end up using our profit for is focusing on these people that don't have either enough money to purchase our tables or can have the most impact when we give them the end crops. Oh, sorry, then. I think technology is definitely a big part, but what we've realized, especially with what works here in Africa, it's word of mouth. The doctor introduced us to the people from the reforestation project. The people from the reforestation project introduced us to a place where we can get seeds for cheaper, etc. So we're trying to follow a little bit of this model, which works really well here in Africa, and expand as much as we can. We don't necessarily want to call this a pivot. Essentially, we're still working on Ellie's farm regular business. But while we have time and while we're confined, we've seen this opportunity. And so far, we're just letting it grow and see where it's going to lead us to.
Yeah, well, when you showed us the garden before, which was super interesting, and you made it sound like so super easy, you just throw out some seeds and things are growing. That never happens for me in any garden. So, you know, I certainly would need like much more instructions for that one. But yeah. I want to come back to the Green Wall Project, because that sounds really interesting. I'm just curious on how it is actually organized. So as, you know, Senegal is planning the Green Wall, is it a project that will be built with the community, or is the government intending to build it? And then how will the food access be coordinated among the different entities? Can you share a little bit more?
It's a public-private cooperation. There's members of the United Nations that work in it. And therefore, their main focus points is in the for the people. The Green Wall is for the people. It's to combat desertification, it's to combat deforestation. So as of right now, from my understanding of how the project operates, is they're looking at the locations in which they're putting the wall, and they're matching the rural areas, the villages, which are in close proximity to that. So they hire individuals from those areas to not only work on the project, but with our help, we combine our farming skills for the self-sufficiency in food. Now, it's so far from my understanding, the self-sufficiency is for the employees, but for each tomato plant, tomato that you grow, there's a couple dozens of seeds in there. And part of our way to help, besides just selling the tables, is having that educational aspect with the kids, showing them how things grow, but for older generations, how to either crossbreed plants or how to do proper transplants, which are successful, how to maximize yields. So that whole educational aspect, we bring that into the table as well. And that's our way to help out. But in terms of the nitty-gritty detail and how the villages are involved, I don't have too much information about that.
Thank you for sharing that. We have a question in the chat from Kathleen. Could you see this on a more local scale, like here in Boston, becoming an operation in collaboration with farmers markets, so people could sort of bring their excess produce on a free vendor stand to get to those who may not know it's out there, as a way to bring the food directly to the community? That's a great question.
That's a really great question. I think it's possible. It's just that in terms of cost of production, for almost any type of crop, it's almost always cheaper to do it here in Africa. Therefore, it will cost more for the production in Boston. And if you want to bring it from one place to the other, it's going to cost more in Boston. So the key is truly having the whole project decentralized. So having as many points where there's people that can do this, so the distances are shorter. And I think that's the main thing, because even here, if things are cheap, if people have to travel far to get it, it's still one way or another, it's either you're paying in time or you're paying in money. So the possibilities are good. I think the models that CJ and Leon are doing, would work, but once again, it's all community-based. It wouldn't make sense from someone to travel from Wellesley to go to Mattapan or from Lynn to go to Mattapan just to do that. There needs to be local community gardens in each one of those locations to make it successful. And also, it takes time to grow stuff. What we have here, granted, only took 2 months, and that's because we have a lot of sun and we were checking on it all the time. And it's we're four brothers, which are very passionate about agriculture, which are working on this. So, you win some, you lose some. But the key, once again, is decentralization and multiplying this initiative as much as possible.
So how could that happen in cities? The work that CJ and Leon are doing is very focused on bringing communities together and, doing it in vacant lots, for example. But can you envision a way where we could actually package that model and bring it to households directly? So there is this empowerment that it could grow on my windowsill, right? It could grow on my porch, for example.
From first guess, I'd say the key would be public-private partnerships. You go to a specific community, you find the businesses which have the most resources, the most land space, and you get members of the community to work together to find a model that works for that specific thing. What's unique about all of these community gardens is that they're all different. They all grow differently. They're all managed by different people. Everyone, one community may need more tomatoes. The other community may need more, onions, for example. So it has to be personalized. And in cities, we have to maximize on rooftop spaces. In France, there was a new law which has been signed recently that all Parisian rooftops which are built in the upcoming years have to be filled with either greenery or solar panels. So by having legislations that facilitate these kinds of initiatives, that's what would make it successful, because you need everyone to be behind this movement.
That's a really cool initiative. To actually put it in regulation. So you're starting to shift the tide towards more access to green spaces. So I have another question for you, because we had a speaker last week who talked about, looking at different countries and different cultures and how they are living and what that could potentially do as we are envisioning our future, right? Can it give us inspiration? Can it give us different clues? So I'm wondering if you could share a little bit more of how communities live in Senegal or in Guinea, and what is it like just from a community perspective? How are family structures? What are the housing situations there? Tell us a little bit more about the living arrangements that go beyond the urban farming concept.
I mean, it honestly varies tremendously by the region and by the level of urbanization. To be honest, from my personal standpoint, in terms of comfort of living, if you have low income, I think that rural lifestyles are more comfortable. They have better management of the way they grow their foods. They have better management of how they generate their living spaces and how the family construct is. In urban areas, especially just mainly on the African continent, it's the fastest growing places, areas in terms of land density for people. Therefore, there was this project that I was actually working on when I was doing an internship in Guinea, where we realized that people in the city, which are a very low income, have rotations for in which the way they sleep, meaning that, you know, there's maybe 10 to 15 individuals in the house, but there's only 3 bedrooms. So if mom has to wake up at 4 to 5 in the morning to go to the market to start selling, we know that the 4 hours prior, she gets the room to sleep. Therefore, the kids have to stay up and either be outside or do work or do things of that sort. I think that one thing which would be inspiring for the way people live and how we can benefit it from what's happening in the world right now is the rural lifestyle. So there's this thing called, I forgot the name, but it's a mathematical equation. It's called fractals. And it's how most atoms are made and how they're shaped. And if you take an aerial photo of most villages in Africa, especially in Guinea, in the region where I'm from originally, there's a way in which the houses are designed. And at the center, it resembles kind of a spiral. In the center, there's the home, which is kind of the equivalent to the nucleus, the most fragile area. And then you go a little bit outside, there's the smaller vegetations, you know, the herbs, the smaller plants, and then you got the larger crops, and then you got the trees, and then you got the animals that you heard. A lot of architects are actually trying to replicate that model in urban areas because it resembles the flow of nature. It's very protective. Those areas, especially, for example, in Guinea, when there was the Ebola crisis, they were the areas which were the least hit. They were the areas where, when there's food crises, are the least hit, the least impacted. And I think maybe it'd be more of the urban design aspect in West African culture, which would be an interesting model to replicate in the U.S., and it could be applied to anything, the way you design a school, the way you design a hospital. And it'll be my pleasure to send you more information about that. And those villages are the ones which truly pioneered the bio-intensive agricultural methods.
Thanks for sharing that. I remember you actually spoke about them when you were considering to expand Elay's farm in Guinea. Right, and having this habitat be also accessible to hospitality at some point. So I appreciate you sharing that because it definitely gives some interesting insights. And it's also challenging, like as we think about COVID, for example, and you have multiple generations living in a house, or you live with multiple people in a fairly small environment. Like what impact did that have on many of the urban environments in Senegal or Guinea?
So there's obviously frustration. You know, as I started speaking, I said that the way we manage even the coronavirus in general varies by location. You know, just a quick example. There was more cases in Germany, but there was more deaths in France. You know, there's a lot that goes into it. There's just like personal traits of people from a specific location. There's the environment. There's the financial situation. So in Guinea, there was at the start a bit more leniency in terms of how important and how dangerous the coronavirus was. So therefore, their cases spiked up. But as soon as there's this sense of realization, the sense of, okay, this is actually serious, this is going to change the way we live and potentially forever, then there's truly an awakening. And once you have that awakening, you can truly see how people react to it. In Guinea, they still have the curfews, things of that sort, but the whole culture of attending to weddings, funerals, baptisms, and other traditional ceremonies was still fairly strong. And that still has an impact on how the cases develop. In Senegal, it was very different, especially in, I can only speak for Dakar, the capital city, because this is where I am. They took it extremely seriously. You know, we're not confined. We're allowed to go out. Restaurants are closed. Public places are closed. But you're still allowed to move around. And I had some friends that were able to come from Guinea to Senegal before the borders were closed. And we saw that they were more willing to go out. And let's go to the beach. Let's go have fun. Let's go out tonight. So it depends by the culture. So the key thing is truly understanding the community, understanding the resources that you have within those communities, and innovating from there. And the way that they've innovated in Guinea in terms of the ceremonies is that, you know, they're starting to introduce, there's this one man that started to film the whole ceremonies and started selling the CDs and USB drives with videos of the ceremony, because it's something which is very strong to the Guinean culture. Here in Senegal, the curfews were very well respected. Honestly, unfortunately, there was a little bit of violence when the first day that the curfews were settled in. But the government said, you know, they stomped their feet and they said, all right, we're bringing out the military. This is real. And the community understood accordingly. And then they had some economic aspects which facilitated things for everyone. You know, it costs less than 5 cents to buy a mask here. In Senegal, to get tested for coronavirus, it costs $1. And if you have the virus, you are taken care of by the government for free. So there's a lot of things which facilitates. Guinea doesn't have that economic power to do something like that. But then you see more of that entrepreneurial community coming in. You see more of that philanthropic spirit coming in. So once again, we have to focus case by case and understand what resources we have.
Thanks for sharing that, Marouf. We have one question come in from Bradley. My grandparents were born and raised on farms, and they had to wake up every morning to contribute to the miscellaneous jobs on the farm. How do we teach our younger generation to contribute back to our society at a young age so that they see the importance of giving back to their communities?
I believe that, you know, each generation brings their own thing. And why I'm very excited to be in this call is because of the people which are in the call. We have people from Wentworth. We have CJ and Leon, which are being innovative within their communities. You have to make it exciting for the kids. You know, when we give a table, which is a table for kids, we don't just give a table and just pure soil on it. That's boring. We give them colored spray cans. We give them stickers at a younger age. And now we're looking at private schools and other public schools where they have more of that STEM aspect, where we say, all right, let's code an Arduino and make a smart irrigation system, you know, things of that sort. There's a lot of things in regards to agriculture which would be seen as boring and as slow. But I think that the beauty of it is you don't actually do a lot of work. You just control elements, sun, water, soil, and you make sure that your plant that you're growing has the best of all those three. And then you don't have to do anything. You just sit back. It's, you don't, if you have it as a business, I say I don't work to make money. The money works for me, because as soon as I'm able to sell that crop, I'm able to reinvest, and then another crop grows. It's similar to real estate. After you've done that whole pain of going through contractors and building the house or the building, then you just have to take care of the tenants, which might be a pain still, but you still end up with a lot of free time. So by marketing it in a more, for lack of a better term, sexy way, kids, people of my generation, younger, will be excited about it. I started Ilya's Farm because I saw my dad going to the farm, and you know, I thought it was boring and it was weird. But when I saw that what my father was doing and how much impact it had, the fact that he had a farm that was self-sufficient, that could run by itself, where the employees there got paid without him bringing external money in, where the employees got free food, where the product is something that people are proud of not only to make but to consume, I think that means the world. There's no better feeling than seeing a seed and then waiting some X amount of time and then being able to, you know, bite that tomato or bite that apple and actually consumed what you produced. It's godly. It's a very, very beautiful experience. And I think depending on every child's personality and specific skill set, they can bring in something which is unique to that. One thing I've done is I have a friend, which actually I did this graffiti on the wall. And it's interactive. There's a door that you can kind of open, but it's not a real door. But what I've done is I call him whenever I go to a different house that we're selling a table to. If there's kids, we sit down and we start painting pots. And that brings in that sense of ownership to the child. It's like, hey, this is my pot. This, my mint flowers are growing here. And then you start seeing competitions like, oh, my mint flower is bigger than your mint flower. And there's that sense of excitement. But once again, you have to understand what skill sets those kids have, what they appreciate, and work from there. One kid did not want to paint. He said, oh, I don't want to get dirty, blah, 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 blah. So we had him kind of draw out the layout of where we're going to put the tables, or, you know, we just have to be very creative. And since everything's more decentralized and has to be more decentralized with what's happening around the world, we get to produce things of higher quality and produce things which are more unique and personalized to each individual and to each community. Maybe the type of innovations that kids from Wentworth would produce would be very different from what the kids from Northeastern would produce. But each one of these parties will be happy with what they produce, because that's what they wanted and they can actually contribute to a project.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Hey, I don't want to let you go before picking your brain on the experiences that you had living through Ebola, because your family already had the farm there. You founded the farm during that time. And I'm just curious to hear, you know, what impact did Ebola have on Senegal and Guinea, or the African country, or the African continent as a whole? But also, you know, what would you expect COVID to do now, and how will we live in the future as a result of that?
Well, I wish I had that answer myself. I don't know how we're gonna live from now, but in terms of Ebola, so Ebola mostly hit Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. It didn't hit Senegal. Actually, as soon as they realized we had Ebola, they closed the borders. so It definitely had a big impact. And back then, we were starting off the business, so we weren't exporting internationally. We were mostly focusing on the local distribution. But even that had an impact. The amount of people that went out in the markets, it was not a year where we were necessarily making large margins or big profits. That year, like this year, what we've done is truly opened our eyes to the different possibilities. That's when we saw that, all right, we have some oil, which is going to go bad, which won't be consumable for as an edible oil. How can we pivot? How can we maximize from our resources and make something useful? And that's when we started making things like black soap. That's when we saw that, all right, you know, the oil still has its nutritional qualities. Let's see what we can do from there. So then, till this day, we know, all right, this is high grade red palm oil. This is lower grade palm oil. There's more fat in this oil. This is better for the production of soap. So now, today, when people are trying to buy soap as well, they rather buy our oil because we learned during that crisis how to kind of separate the different qualities of oil and how to create the best in each class. The communities are definitely going to suffer. There is definitely an economic impact. You know, before Ebola and even today, Guinea's GDP is continuously increasing. Sometimes it's really great. It's double digits. But during the Ebola crisis, it really hit us. And it's kind of ironic because we're living in the current day Ebola, and there's a lot of stigma around Ebola. You know, you could have a South African coming to Europe or to the States, and they'll be like, oh, you're from Africa, you have Ebola, there's Ebola in your country. But Ebola was mostly centralized, and for the past pandemic, was mostly centralized in West Africa. So there's no real answer to the question of what do we do, how do we pivot. It's just trial and error. At first we thought that we would be growing plants here at the house and then just selling the plants. But that didn't make sense for us because, you know, that's why there's large-scale agriculture. You have more things. They harvest all at the same time. You can distribute. But here, if we mess up one crop, for example, our zucchinis, they didn't do well at all. You know, that's just pure loss. So now we saw, all right, what we're good at is actually making the plants strong, providing a good soil from them, and then having them grow. So let's focus on that and sell that aspect. So I think regardless of the industry, things are going to change. And we have to just be open-minded and willing to take risks. Because, you know, when we told our mom that we were going to chop the garden in half and plant stuff on it, she wasn't very happy. She was like, oh, you guys are going to start growing and then you're just going to abandon it and it's not going to happen. But now whenever we send her a picture of our cucumbers and tomatoes and the beautiful salad that we made, she's jealous and she's proud. So there has to be a willingness to take a risk. A willingness, once again, you have to understand the market. You might have an amazing innovation. You might have an amazing product. You might have it at an amazing price. And your timing might be right. But if you don't have the proper market that wants it, it's not going to work. For example, I can tell you right now that the price at which we grow, we make the tables here in Senegal to sell for, we definitely can't do that in Guinea. In Guinea, things grow easily, and a lot of the stuff that is consumed in Senegal is actually imported from Guinea. Senegal is very desertic, But since we mastered that growing process within this current environment, people have, we bring more value, therefore people are more willing to pay for it. So yeah, high risks, understanding once again the environment, and be willing to pivot and try new things. We tried stuff, we failed, and we're still failing, but that's the only way to learn.
Thank you so much for sharing this, and I really appreciated you taking the time. It was wonderful to see you again from Senegal. I'm glad you're doing well, you're safe, and you are growing a garden, and you make it sound it's just like a cakewalk, which totally is not. But I really appreciate you dialing in. Thank you for your time, and I can't wait to see you again in Accelerate.
All right. Thank you so much for everything, and I hope everyone's safe and doing well.